This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to Arjun Talks. Joining me for a special In Conversation With episode is Justin Anukasi, Head of Retail Multi-Asset Funds here at Elgin. Before joining Elgin in 2013, Justin had worked at companies including Aviva Investors, Merrill Lynch and Aon. Whilst he's a fund manager by trade, Justin is a hugely respected and recognised diversity champion in investment management, using his voice and influence to help move the dial and create a more inclusive industry. He's here to share his story and insights. Welcome to Elgin Talks, Justin.
Thank you, John.
So to get started, you've had quite an impressive career so far, but I'd like to take you back to the very start. When did you decide to pursue a career in investments, and what was it that inspired you to want to be a fund manager?
It's a really interesting question, because when I was growing up, I never really wanted to go into investments or be a fund manager. So I started off wanting to be a doctor, inspired by my father. Even though I lived in a single parent household, my dad lived in the US, and I was in Manchester with my mum and my brother. And he still had a lot of influence. He had a lot of influence on me. And, you know, a sort of typical Igbo, so East Nigerian, culture, you know, it's either doctor, lawyer or engineer. And so I wanted to be a doctor at first, got to my teenage years, switched to wanting to be a lawyer. And then towards the end of my schooling, I had an affinity to maths, and I was clearly reasonably strong at that. And so that clearly led itself, or would lend itself, to a finance related role. But it was really when I did my open day at my sixth form college, and I was walking around deciding what A-levels to take. And I wanted to do maths because that's what I was strong at. Then politics was another subject I wanted to do, given the time, so 1998, giving away my age a little bit. And this is when New Labour was coming into, had just come into power, and Manchester had finally got the party that it votes for in power. So there's like a nice kind of, I suppose, a breath of fresh air around politics, if you remember at the time. And so I wanted to learn more about that. And then economics kind of sat in the middle between maths and politics, so it made sense to do that. It's actually by walking around the open day and bumping into the head of maths. I think his name was Mr. Kiley, but I might be wrong on that. I remember bumping into him and him saying, look, having these grades, my grades in front of him, and saying, well, given you're so strong at maths, you should take up a career in the actuarial profession. And I was like, what's that? Well, what's an actuary? And he was like, well, it's a secret profession. It's the most lucrative profession in the world. And you get to use maths as well. I was like, well, that's no brainer, right? It makes sense. I might as well go and do that. Well, first of all, he lied. It's not the most lucrative profession in the world, as we know. And actually, when I got to the University of Economics and I applied like crazy to loads of actuarial jobs, I finally got into the actuarial profession. I think it was after 60, maybe even 70 applications to different businesses. So I got on the graduate scheme at Aon in the pension consulting team and realised I absolutely hated it, you know, within a few months. And it's nothing to do with actuaries, or, you know, it's a really good profession, and credit to anybody that does that. But it just wasn't for me. So I was really kind of exploring what is for me, and almost by luck. And throughout my career, I think that luck has played a massive part in where I've got to. It was a training course for the graduate scheme, and the investment consulting team came in to talk about what they do. And it was almost within 10 minutes of that conversation, within 10 minutes of that presentation, I knew that I wanted to go to investment consulting. So 5-6 months into the role, I emailed the head of investment consulting out of the blue and just said, what would it take for me to come and join your team? And then within a month, I was interviewing with a team leader and him. They asked me some questions. I clearly did well. I don't know what I said, but I clearly did well. And then a month later, I was sat on the investment consulting floor. And it was since then I realized that investing was my passion, and whatever I did in my career going forward, investments had to be a part of it.
You mentioned that you also considered becoming a doctor or lawyer. What was it about those professions that appealed to you, and what do you think you would have specialised in?
That's a really good question. So I think from a lawyer perspective, it would have to be a barrister. And probably growing up, my mum used to watch this programme called LA Law. And I always used to be really fascinated by the dynamics of the lawyers in the US and how they were, you know, how they defend or prosecute, et cetera, et cetera. I think I'd be a defense lawyer.
Through all your different roles that you've taken, as you say, you didn't start off being a fund manager. What do you think were the most valuable? What was the most valuable lesson that you learned that has helped you become the fund manager you are today?
I think the key lesson is being a fund researcher, actually. So when I left Aon, I went to Merrill Lynch and I was doing fund research. And the hours at Merrill Lynch were very long, as you'd expect from working at a bank, an American bank. But we used to, like, you know, 12, 13, 14 hour days. And I used to interview fund managers left, right, and center. I used to interview loads and loads of fund managers as a fund researcher. And the Merrill Lynch model is built on volume, right? Yeah, it's about interviewing lots and lots of different managers and coming up with opinions. And I think that by sitting on the other side of the table and understanding what I like from fund managers has really helped me in the way I communicate as a fund manager to my clients, but also to researchers as well, is that I believe that I can truly empathize with their situation. And I think that just makes me it makes me relatable. So I do think being a fund researcher had a significant part to play in shaping the fund manager that I am today.
So on a similar topic, what do you think defines you as a fund manager?
So I think that the fund management as a whole, as time has gone on, it's become harder and harder to differentiate between different fund managers, right? You know, clearly cost is a key element which people use as a differentiator. But I also think humility is important as well. You know, being able to understand and articulate actually not only where you've been right, but also where you've been wrong. And being able to then analyze those decisions and understand actually where you went wrong. I think that the last thing, which is really important in any investment, but particularly fund management roles, you mentioned it, is kind of drive and resilience. I'll probably put them together because, you know, it is very challenging that when you do go through periods that aren't going so well, when you do go through those periods of poor performance, and this is where a strong support network is really important, either within your team or actually just outside of your business as well, that you can lean on and call on for support when times are tough.
What's your favourite part of your job?
From a fund management perspective, it's working with intelligent, humble, and a strong team. I think the team that we've built, the asset allocation team, is, you know, we've got our own defined culture. We've seen, you know, huge amounts of growth. And I think overall, both across retail and the institutional market, the brand from an asset allocation perspective is strong. There's still a lot more to do, don't get me wrong. There's still a lot more work to be done to kind of grow that even further. But I think the investment excellence that we strive for as a team has been achieved. And hopefully, with the work we're going to put in, we can continue that going forward.
What's been your biggest challenge so far?
The biggest challenge I've had in my career has definitely been in 2020. And it was driven by a number of things all happening at the same time. So you saw the quickest bear market on record. Subsequently, you saw the quickest bull market on record. You had the George Floyd incident, which, you know, as a Black leader in the investment industry, that really scarred me. And the reaction that I was expected to have and show leadership at a time when, you know, I was suffering was pretty hard. And not only that's not only within the industry, that's outside of the industry, thinking about my family as well. At the same time, my mum had cancer, and she recovered from that. But, you know, I found out on the first day of lockdown that she was diagnosed with cancer. And then also at the same time, my wife was having an operation as well. So, you know, then the kids were at home, homeschooling, all of that coming together. That has to be my biggest challenge. Not only did I have a professional challenge, but I also had that kind of personal family challenge, which was just very difficult to deal with all at the same time.
And how did you manage? What helped you get through it all?
I think it's just having that support network. Again, I'll point to Luck in that I've been able to build, you know, really strong friendships from my university and school days. I come from a big family. So again, lots of cousins, aunties. My mum, you know, going through all of that was really strong throughout the whole period. And then, you know, although it was tough, actually having my, you know, my children at home, it was also a blessing because it meant that particularly in the early days of lockdown, I was able to spend a lot more time with them. And you really appreciate, you know, what's important. And I've got to say, I was helped as well by markets rebounding very quickly. And, you know, that just naturally as a fund manager, when markets are going up, you feel better than when markets are going down. So, yeah, I think all of those things combined really helps to navigate that difficult situation.
Of course. And on the flip side, what has been your proudest moment to date?
I think the proudest moment, actually, quite perversely, has actually been coming out of that, and realizing that if you do have a long-term vision, if you do have a long-term goal, both from a professional and personal perspective, that you may get deterred from that goal, but it's so important to have that goal and have that vision. And I think now, you know, following being taken off path, that I'm now back on that path. And I think now going back towards, got back towards that vision. My mum's recovered, been given the all clear. My wife's operation was successful. So, yeah, I'm back on that path now. Also, I do think the I Am campaign that we did in response to the George Floyd killing, the way the industry took that on, the way LGIM supported me and also the industry in helping to drive that forward was a real positive.
I know I speak for everyone when I say we're all so glad things are better for you and your family. We're going to talk more about your diversity work, but before that, I just have one question. So you're known for having your finger on the pulse as to advisor issues. So what do you think are the key challenges and opportunities for advisors?
As you say, I do try and understand the landscape, understand what advisors are going through. I think there are a number of trends that are worthwhile exploring. The first one is around costs. I still think we're in an environment where costs are fundamentally important, and advisors are really trying to drive down the costs of their overall investments. So that still continues. And I think with that, you're going to see the continued rise of index funds. And you're going to see active managers continually being pushed down on price as well from advisors. So I think that's one challenge or one trend. The second one is around ESG. I don't really need to go into this in a huge amount of detail, but there are a few things I'd say. The emphasis from advisors so far has been on climate change. As you've gone from ethical funds to more sustainable ESG funds, it's all been on the E of ESG. I do think as time is going on, the S is going to become more in focus. And I do think then managers then have to adapt to that. And instead of focusing predominantly on just the climate change side, which is really important, don't get me wrong, but I do think when investors want to invest responsibly, they want the S and the G as well. And I do think the S is going to become, or the social side is going to become a lot more important, that companies need to have a social conscience and investors will hold their advisors to account if their investments don't tick that box. They're the two key things that I'd say. I'd add one more thing in there. I do think model portfolios are going to become more important. They're going to be a continued driver, continued growth alongside multi-asset. So I do think it's important as advisors to clearly be aware of both suites when they're thinking about building their centralized investment propositions.
You've made waves with your diversity campaigning, both at LGIM and within the wider industry, and you were even awarded the Freedom of the City of London thanks to your impressive work to push for a more inclusive industry. You've also launched the Talk About Black initiative. Can you tell me a bit more about that and what motivated you to do this?
The first element of this is, I said, why am I interested in diversity and inclusion, full stop? And the first, that element is really driven by, I've looked at my journey and how I've got to where I've got to. And I just recognize the different interventions that I've had along the way that many people simply don't have. Many people don't have a mother who's focused on education, who's a teacher, which helps. And education, I think, is still the key to social mobility. Many people don't have the privilege of having managers, line managers in every role they've had that have been so supportive and sponsors and fought for me in terms of getting promotion and visibility and profile. And many people can get sucked into, particularly in the early days, in the teenage years, can get sucked into getting involved in bad influences, et cetera, again, given the strong family network I had, and actually given the strong network of friends I had at the time, I managed to avoid all of that. So I do see myself as being very lucky to have avoided that. So one of the key things I want to try and do is to make sure that people with the same background as me have the opportunity, just the opportunity, to be able to apply for roles that I'm in, apply for roles in the city, and simply be seen on a level playing field with others. Then on the, from a Talk About Black perspective, Talk About Black as an initiative was really, or my involvement in it was really driven by the ex-CIO and ex-CEO bringing me into their office and saying, Justin, you are focused on, you are the kind of the head of diversity and inclusion for the investment floor. At the time, I'd launched the investment diversity working group for the investment floor. But they asked me a question. They said, we understand that there's underrepresentation for ethnic minorities, but why are there so few Black people? Like, why are Black people so underrepresented, even within ethnic minorities? And it was then that I turned towards the diversity projects and the ethnicity work stream and the diversity projects. And in my first meeting there, they were talking about exactly this. why are there so few Black people at senior levels in the investment management industry? And really, it was from those discussions that Talk About Black was formed, because you recognize that actually you have to start talking about the issue. You have to be comfortable with talking about the issue. It cannot be a taboo. It cannot continue to be a taboo if we're going to make the change that we want to make. And hashtag Talk About Black was born from that. And yeah, we haven't looked back since.
So as one of the most senior Black men in the investment management industry, how has it been for you personally forging this career for yourself, especially in an industry that is not known for its diversity?
It's been a challenge. So I think the best way to look at this is my early career, my career now, and then going forward, what I think the future entails. So in the earlier years, before I'd built any kind of profile, it used to really, you know, concern me, you know, when I'd turn up at a conference and people would mistaken me for, you know, the technology person, or, you know, I'd be pouring a drink of tea for myself at the coffee trolley, and then a queue of IFAs would just appear behind me and they'll think that I'm the tea boy pouring tea for people. And, you know, those things used to concern me. And I suppose now, as I've, you know, progressed into the fund management role, first of all, a lot of those things have gone away because I've just got more profile now, clients tend to know who I am, et cetera, et cetera. Also, I'm very vocal on diversity, so I'd probably call it out a lot quicker than I did. In fact, I just didn't call it out, you know, because of all those years ago. But I do think right now there is a challenge with people who are seen as diversity and inclusion leaders. And this is right across the industry, where it's very difficult to continue to do your, you know, your day job and focus on that, but at the same time, try and drive change within an industry which is, you know, let's be honest, is taking a long time to change. So what, you know, what does the future entail? I think the future entails businesses taking the baton off diversity leaders and say, we're going to now treat this as a business issue. And I think LGIM has really taken the lead in this. You know, I sit in the Diversity and Inclusion Leadership Council, which is chaired by the CEO of the business. So this is a business issue, and the CEO is taking it on herself to drive the changes through the business that needs to happen. I think that is fundamentally important. And I think the only way we really drive real change is by leaders taking responsibility. So the CEO at the top of businesses taking responsibility and driving change to cultures throughout their business.
That's really valuable advice that I hope a lot of companies are going to take on board. I want to go a little bit more into your personal experiences, if you don't mind. You often talk about the kinks in the hose pipe. What's been the most powerful example of a kink that you faced, and how did you overcome it?
Just to take a step back, the kinks in the hose pipe, as defined by Talk About Black and one of its co-founders, Dawid Konate Ahulu, there are five kinks. The first one is taboo. We've already spoken about that. The fact that when it comes to ethnicity, people don't want to talk about it and are often afraid to talk about it, given the impact it can have on their reputation. We've seen lots of examples of that more recently. And then the other four kinks are community. This is the difficulty of detangling ethnicity from social mobility, which is a challenge. Then you come to pipeline, and this is when you get into the educational system. Black people and other ethnicities tend to start at the same level playing field. But as you get through the schooling system towards the end, then because of biases, because of the educational system being focused a certain way, because of social mobility, you can't ignore that again. Black people then underperform at the end of the end as you get to kind of the GCSE period. You know, clearly that's a challenge. But even when black people are getting the right grades, they're still not getting the top jobs in the asset management industry, but actually across the corporate sphere. This isn't just an asset management problem, this is a corporate sphere problem. And then finally, the final kink, when they get into the workplace, black people, even though they've got the same attainment, the same grades, are not getting the same progression rates as other ethnicities. So community, pipeline, entry, and progression and stability, which we mentioned. So when I think about my career and I think about the biggest challenge, I do think there is something fundamentally flawed in the way people apply, get accepted and rejected for roles, because I know that I would not have got the role at Merrill's, I would not have got the role at Aviva Investors without having that strong network and knowing somebody who was able to vouch for me before I even started the interview process.
Clearly, achieving true diversity and inclusion requires commitment from all of us. We've discussed what companies can do, but what should individuals do to become allies and to help turn the dial?
I think the first thing is really deciding what type of ally you want to be. I always get a little bit confused and frustrated sometimes when people ask me, I don't know, you know, they'll come to me and say, how can I support? I don't know, really know what to do. And the one question I always think, I never really ask the question, but it's, I always think, I didn't create these barriers. I didn't create these structural hurdles. So therefore, why would I have the solutions? So I do think it is up to the businesses to understand these barriers and these hurdles and try and break them down. I think that's the first thing. But I think understanding what type of ally you want to be. I think there's lots of press and lots of publicity and lots of profile around those allies that will go onto social media and say, you know, and wave the flag and say, look, you know, look what I'm doing, et cetera, et cetera. I support this cause. And that's great. You know, that is needed. That's definitely needed. But I also think that the allies that can be supporters, you know, that shoulder to cry on almost when times are tough. Sponsors, you know, one of the biggest challenges, I think, for mid-level and senior professionals, and this isn't just black people, this is right across the board, I think the industry can do better at sponsoring talent. I think that's a huge challenge for the industry, but for the corporate sphere as a whole. Also, you know, you can be an ally by calling things out. So my point is, or you can be an ally from just researching. You know, researching, understanding the challenge, understanding the issues, and educating others. So my point here is that allyship can take various different forms. But the important thing is, this isn't an identity. Allyship isn't an identity. It's a verb. You actually have to do something to be an ally. And I think that is vitally important to understand. And how you choose to be an ally is up to you. But you have to do something.
So what advice would you give to young Black professionals or professionals from ethnic minorities who want to join this industry and become the leaders of tomorrow?
I'd probably give this advice to anybody, actually, but in particular, I suppose, ethnic minorities. A lot of the time, culturally, we're taught to, you know, work twice as hard to get half as much. And this is a phrase that, well, definitely when I was growing up, was a phrase that really stuck with me and meant that actually drove me to work really hard, actually. But I do think working hard purely from a technical perspective, that isn't enough. You have to think about the whole package. So not just the hard skills, the softer skills. And over time, that's what I've learned to give a lot of focus on. And I think, you know, you come back to those skill sets that I think I have as a fund manager, you know, humility and resilience and all, these are softer skills. So I always try and say, look, you know, if you're going to work hard on your on those technical skills, you also need to work hard on building those meaningful relationships. Because it's only when you build those meaningful relationships that you're going to get sponsorship, that you're going to, you know, people move on. They move on to different businesses. You build your network by people you build relationships with when they move on to different businesses, et cetera, et cetera. And I do think that is vitally, vitally important. I also think there are a number of now initiatives that can really help those that are underrepresented in the industry get onto that playing field where I think then it becomes level. I'm thinking things like the End Circle mentoring circles, where, you know, role models will present on different challenges that they've been through in the industry in order to inspire others. I think they're, you know, those things are vitally important. And then I think also we're in the world where social media is becoming more and more important. So if I'm interviewing somebody and they're telling me that they're passionate, particularly at junior levels, they're passionate about investing and so on and so forth, I want to be able to look on their social media platforms and be able to see evidence of this. If their social media platforms are saying something completely different, that to me is almost a concern straight away. I do think that now in this work, in this kind of the world that we're in, where social media platforms are becoming more relevant, your brand, your personal brand is becoming more important, and you can define that from a very junior, early age and build on that as you come into employment.
Are you hopeful for the future? You look at maybe even the last 12 months, do you think enough progress has been made?
I think some progress has been made. I think there's definitely a lot more to go. I do think that a lot of corporates still don't know what to do, how to sponsor people, how to drive change. And let's be honest, there are lots of different conflicting priorities, whether it's ESG, whether it's low cost, whether it's consolidation in the industry, that a lot of companies are wrestling with. But I do think the companies that are successful at this will be the leaders and the winners of tomorrow. And this isn't just about what your company looks like. It's about your overall culture. So the companies that are going to be successful are those which adapt their culture for the people that they have within the business. I think historically, what businesses have done is have said, this is our culture. And everybody that comes in has to adapt to it. But the difficulty with that is the more different you are, the less you are, the more different you are to the largest group in that business, whether you're female, whether you're black, whether you're, you know, disabled, LGBT, et cetera, the harder it is to adapt to that culture and be your authentic self. So what's happening is that the businesses that are successful in creating an inclusive culture are now saying, look, we recognize our culture has to embrace all of this difference. So we have to be aware of that and be flexible in thinking about our overall culture. And they're the businesses that will, I think, win in the future.
Talking about the future, what are your plans? Where do you see yourself in the next few years? What do you wish to have achieved by then?
From an investment perspective, it's to continue to build a successful retail multi-asset business. Then from a diversity and inclusion perspective, I think we'll continue to drive societal change. I think it is about now going forward, about really looking at different cultures and businesses and really doing what I can to help those within those businesses drive change. And I am really quite hopeful that we can create a true level playing field in the corporate sphere. And in 5, 10, 20 years' time, the industry will be more representative of society at large.
Exciting and optimistic note to end that on. Justin, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for having me.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating, or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous, on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and general investment management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, LGIM.com.